Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Alan Orenberg. I represent the appellant, Terry Davis. I will dispense with a recitation of the facts of the case unless the Court wants to hear about the timeline in the background, because my time is short. I'm asking the Court today to make a decision, which I believe is a case of first impression, a novel issue in this jurisdiction, regarding when does supervised release begin under 18 U.S.C. 3624E. I'm also going to ask the Court, notwithstanding in my brief where I asked the Court to employ an abuse of discretion standard, I'm going to ask the Court to use a de novo standard of review, because I'm asking the Court to make a statutory interpretation of the statute, the subject statute today.
What about the question of plain error, lack of objection below?
Well, Your Honors, if you take a look at the record back before the second sentencing on March 14th, 2011, there was a status call about 3 weeks earlier on February 25th. And at that time, I believe the record demonstrates that my client, through his district court counsel — I was not district court counsel — and together with government counsel, was asking the Court for a one-year term of supervised release.
That's not this issue, though, right?
No, it's not this issue, but
you weren't saying count the time from the time of the prior release.
I'm sorry?
You weren't saying count as supervised release time already essentially spent the time from the time of the prior release, right?
So that was not articulated on either.
Right. All I understood, it was agreed upon that it would be 1 year. Both sides would agree to 1 year supervised release. The judge rejected that, but I didn't see the argument you're now making made in the district court.
That is correct. But nevertheless, I think that the issue was sufficiently raised that this Court could, in its discretion, employ a de novo standard of review.
How can we count
the issue is statutory? You say it's a matter of statutory interpretation, but it's certainly a new interpretation of, at least it's an interpretation of the statute that has no support in the Supreme Court or here. So that sounds to me like it could not be classified as a clear error.
Well, I don't disagree with you, Judge Williams. In fact, the case law that touches upon this issue is not very illuminating. I don't think it's totally instructive on the issue.
There's one case, Vallejo, it goes against you, right?
Well, the difference in that case is that that defendant in that case was rearrested after he was released the first time, and they were trying to make an argument that a supervised release should relate back to prior to the rearrest on a violent charge, I believe it was a weapons charge in that case. This is different. This court is well aware, overturned the district court's convictions and ordered the release of my client. He was released in December of 2009. It took another 13 months before the case was negotiated, resolved, and he was resentenced. And I'm asking the Court to relate back or to
but
use the...
How can that prior time be considered time spent on supervised release when it wasn't? The usual conditions were not in place, nor legally could they have been in place, because there was no valid conviction in place at that point.
There was no valid conviction in place at that point, but I would argue to the Court that the pretrial release order signed by Judge Walton on December 17, 2009, mm-hmm. put in a sufficient number of conditions that are akin to those conditions that one would find.
They're not the same as the one that would be imposed under supervised release.
They're not exactly the same. Under the supervised release order, which is in starts at page 112 of the joint appendix, the significant difference between the supervised release order and the prior pretrial release order is the requirement of DNA testing. There was a change in the restitution amount. I want to address this for a second. In the final judgment and commitment order, the restitution amount was $50,000, but in the original sentence by the Court back in August of 2007, Judge Walton imposed an order of restitution much higher, $221,000. So the appellant, then defendant in the district court, was well aware that he was going to have to make restitution. In fact, in that prior judgment order, the court instructed that, you know, there was a certain monthly payment and perhaps some of it should be taken from his prison pay. So it's not like it was a brand new condition imposed upon the appellant in this case. He was well aware from August of 2007 that he was going to have an order of restitution along the way.
Can I just ask, it's a question of whether there was any kind of a thing that we could read as an objection on this line before. What your client originally argued for was a one-year supervised release.
Right? Correct.
And under your theory, if what he was really asking for was to count the previous time, he would have been released immediately, right? That is, upon the moment of sentencing, he would be allowed to walk out.
Well, he was allowed to walk. It was a sentence to time served.
No, but walk out without supervised release.
Well, right? Counsel makes that.
Isn't that right?
Well, if it was 1 year, yes. But Judge Walton imposed 5 years.
He did, but in terms of what your client was asking for at the time, is it conceivable that either he or the government thought that the consequence of the 1 year supervised release would be no supervised release?
It's conceivable. I will grant you that.
Inconceivable.
Inconceivable. Thank you, Your Honor. I will also point out to the court, with respect to the reasoning of Judge Walton in imposing the lengthier term of supervised release, one of his points was that he wanted to make sure that Mr. Davis paid back the money. Now, I would ask the court to take notice, and it's been my experience with a number of my clients, that in the district court, if a client is required to pay back money restitution, that when the term of supervised release is coming to an end, the United States government often requires that person to sign a confessed judgment note to the United States so that there would be something in place after the period of supervised release expires that would hopefully ensure that the defendant or appellant keeps paying back the money owed.
Now you're taking issue, I take it, with the idea of 5 years, which wasn't the issue you raised.
No, it's not. I'm just pointing that out as sort of a background to the court had asked me a few minutes ago, what's the difference? What are the difference in conditions? Well, frankly, there's no real difference in conditions. He was still reporting to a court officer, albeit during that 13 months, a probation officer rather than, a pretrial services officer rather than a probation officer. And essentially all the other conditions were the same, except for the DNA testing. I think my time is about to run out. I've reserved 2 minutes of rebuttal, unless the court would like have any more questions for me at this time.
Thank you. The time. Thank you. Hear from the United States.
May it please the court, Christopher Maccioroli on behalf of the United States of America. Your Honors, the appellant's principal argument on appeal is that when this court released him from custody on December 4, 2009, the term of supervised release commenced. That claim is without merit because this court's own order, its own December 4, 2009 order, stated, and I quote, "It is ordered on the court's own motion that appellant be released forthwith pending resolution of this appeal, subject to the terms and conditions of pretrial release set by the district court on July 12, 2006. There should be no doubt to any party to this action that the appellant was subject to the least restrictive conditions of pretrial release, a distinct and statutory different set of features than supervised release. And in fact, the district court, less than 2 weeks later, modified the pretrial release conditions that the appellant was placed on personal recognizance.
This goes a little bit to an argument about what the intent of our court was or what the intent of the district court was. I understood that the ultimate bottom line argument of the defendant here is not about the intent of any party, but the statute, and the statute says something, and regardless of the intent of the judge or this court, statute governs. Well, and that provision that he is referring to is the one that says a term of supervised release commences on the day the person is released from imprisonment. So even if there was some mistake and he wasn't given the full requirements of supervised release, nonetheless, that's when the term begins.
Yeah.
What's the answer to that argument?
Judge Garland, if you look at the specific section from which that phrase comes, 18.
That's what I'm doing.
18 U.S.C. 3624E. A prisoner whose sentence includes a term of supervised release after imprisonment shall be released by BOP to the supervision of a probation officer. There was no release to probation. The appellant was required to make contact with a pretrial service agency, a totally different agency of the United States government, totally different than the U.S. Probation Office. Reason being, two totally different statutory schemes. One, pretrial release, the least restrictive conditions to ensure two things. One, that the defendant appears at his next court appearance and that there's no danger to the community, vis-a-vis supervised release, where an individual is now a convicted defendant and has numerous conditions. An appellant's argument that the conditions were equivalent is without merit. If anyone has been convicted of a crime and has to go through probation, they are subject to inspections by a probation officer with very little notice and sometimes without notice. As appellant concedes, they're subject to DNA testing and the possibility that they may have been linked to another crime. They are restricted from incurring certain debts. Those conditions are extremely different than the one-page order, the standard pretrial order that is issued by a district court, which basically says that the individual is not to commit other crimes while he's on personal custody.
Well, couldn't be on supervised release for a vacated conviction.
Absolutely.
That's the key
point, Judge Kavanaugh. There was
legally couldn't be.
There was no order in place. There was no supervised release. There was no order setting forth how long it had to be, what the conditions would be. That order was vacated by this court.
I'm struggling a little bit with the text of the statute and see if I can maybe rephrase your argument about this. So the text says the term of supervised release commences on the day the person is released from imprisonment. And I take it your argument is that that has to be read in the context of the preceding sentence, which is about a prisoner whose sentence includes a term of supervised release after imprisonment, and that hadn't yet been imposed. So that this section, which defines supervised release, didn't come into play until the subsequent resentencing.
Judge Garland, that is absolutely correct, and that's exactly what the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decided in Vallejo. They basically said that the purpose of supervised release wasn't in place in that case when the person was released after his convictions, akin to appellant having his convictions overturned. And I object to the appellant's argument that Vallejo is somehow different in this case. While it is not binding on this court, the reasoning and the factual situation are applicable to the facts before this court. And just responding to certain points and questions raised from your honors, first, as Judge Williams mentioned, there was absolutely no discussion whatsoever at the district court about this issue. No discussion whatsoever, not even in passing. Plain error is the correct standard to be applied here. And given that the only case law we have on this subject is from the Ninth Circuit, it favors the government. So there is no real argument that the error, if there was an error, it was plain or obvious. Going to Judge Williams's other point, there was no argument raised in the briefs in this case challenging the length of the restitution, whether it be 1 year or 3 years or 5 years. The sole issue in this case is when does the period of supervised release commence? That's the only issue that's been briefed to this court. And as just
you're saying that if the issue had been raised, the judge could have said, all right, I'll assume you're right. I'll assume arguendo that it starts at your earlier release, and I'll add on whatever the requisite number of years is to make it up.
Judge, right? Absolutely correct. The district court
There was no ceiling to prevent that.
The district court could have done a number of things. Could have sided with appellant, could have split the baby in the middle and given him some credit in the court's equitable discretion. A variety of things could have been done. That wasn't addressed, and it goes directly to the purpose of the plain error standard. And as Judge Garland mentioned in one of his questions, it is completely unreasonable and unconceivable that the government would allocute for 1 year of supervised release at a sentencing, knowing that, according to the argument of appellate, supervised release was over. It is inconceivable.
I hate to throw this monkey wrench into the argument, but why are we here? That is, he was sentenced. In what way do we know that the district court is interpreting his supervised release one way or the other? What decision of the district court? The decision of the district court is nothing other than the announcement of 5 years of supervised release. Has he sought any kind of determination as to when that time period began?
My understanding of the record, Judge Garland, is that there's been made no challenge at the district court level regarding when this period of time commences.
It's even possible that the district court completely agrees with him, and there's just been no determination one way or the other yet.
There's been no motion for modification, no argument raised at the district court.
Motion for clarification, it would be, on this hypothesis.
Absolutely, right. Judge Williams.
Right.
And to answer your question, Judge Garland, we're here because appellant is basically claiming that her supervised release should end about 16 months earlier.
Well, but do we need to, and one question would be, do we need to wait until he doesn't show up saying that I'm not on supervised release anymore, and the judge then holds a hearing on the question of whether he should be held in violation? I mean, what is the decision from which there's an appeal at this point? That's why I say I hate to throw a monkey wrench here, but normally we only hear appeals from decisions of some kind.
Yeah. Judge, I think that's a question more appropriate for appellant.
Well, the government still has
to
tell
us. You have to help us find jurisdiction.
Both sides have to tell us whether we have jurisdiction.
Your Honor, I would say this is an appropriate challenge to a sentence of 5 years of supervised release, and the question being,
because you're quite clear what it means, and he's objecting to what you think is the clear meaning.
I think it was very clear to everybody who was at that hearing. In fact, the record reflects at the district court level that Judge Walton notified appellant that it was his inclination to impose a 5-year period of supervised release, and given appellant's concern about that period of time, gave him a continuance to consider whether he wanted to go ahead with his plea of guilty and if he wanted to withdraw his plea. So,
seems unlikely from the record as a whole that Judge Walton would have thought this meant 5 years minus the time already served on pretrial release.
I take it that in essence has got to be the appellant's position. The statute requires X. But it's obvious from context that the judge meant not X, which is a conceivable view. That gives us jurisdiction.
My time is out, Your Honors, but if you have any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to be clear. It is our position, it is my position, that the term of supervised release commences on the day of that the person is released from imprisonment. That's what the statute says.
Right. Just to back up on the jurisdictional question, so I was a little uncertain from your brief whether you think it's unclear what the district court meant and wanted, or whether it's clear and that's why, and clear and wrong, and that's why you're appealing.
Clear and wrong.
Okay. So the basis of our jurisdiction is the district court gave an unlawful sentence, namely one in contradiction to the statute, because it contemplated supervised release beginning from the date of the sentencing.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
I just also wanted to point out briefly when you take a look at the Vallejo case from the Ninth Circuit and the other cases, there's discussion about reintegration of society, of the defendant or the prisoner, the released prisoner, back into society, and that's why the conditions are imposed. Well, reintegration was occurring when he was released by this court, and Judge Walton set pretrial conditions of release. As I said, essentially the same conditions were set, save for the DNA.
But Judge Walton knew that and still wanted 5 years.
Right. He wanted 5 years because he also said he was a little unhappy with my client's lack of remorsefulness
right,
and contrition with the court.
Though.
But he also said he wanted to make sure, quote, my client pays every penny back. But as I said, there are other means by which the United States can employ, if they so choose.
I'm not sure what this argument goes to. That's what I thought that argument went to, the idea that maybe Judge Walton really wasn't insisting on 5 actual years because it could have been paid back, and so maybe he didn't mean 5 years. But you just told me that actually you agree he did mean 5 years, so then what's the difference? I mean, why does it matter one way or the other whether reintegration could have been and compensation could have been paid unless. Why does it make any difference?
I'm not so sure that it would make a difference. But one thing, I noticed my time is almost up, but I'd like to perhaps elaborate or suggest to the court on something that it raised, that if we're uncertain about what Judge Walton meant, I believe this court would have the authority to remand this case back to the district court. Maybe
you're not uncertain about what he meant.
Well, from the record,
no. You just said that. Yeah, from the record as a whole.
But if this court is uncertain, it could take that somewhat unusual step and ask the district court to clarify its position, and then we could resume or rebrief and come back together again, whatever the court prefers. Does the court have any more questions? Otherwise, I see the red light. I think my time is up.
Sorry.
Thank you very much, and have a good weekend.
Mr. Orenberg, you were appointed by the court to represent the appellant.
Yes, sir.
You've done a fine job, and we appreciate your assistance.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
And as usual, we appreciate the assistance of the United States. We'll take